Well, so I didn't go immediately to the Huffington Post. First, I went to this network that is now, I don't know if it still exists. It might have been bought. There's this network called Plum TV, which was sort of like it was only in sort of affluent vacation markets, so like Vail and Martha's Vineyard and Sun Valley and the Hamptons. And it was sort of like program, like local programming, but then they had like a national office in New York where we would do sort of national programming. So like I worked on a show called Beyond the Boardroom with Jonathan Tisch. And so he would interview other CEOs and then that show would be like sort of broadcast throughout all the markets. So I was an assistant producer there first. And then the company was like in serious financial trouble, and it was the guy who started Nantucket Nectars. It was like his television channel network. Anyway, so I got laid off. I got laid off in like around December, and a friend of mine from high school was working at the Huffington Post on the blog team, and he knew that I was applying to grad school, and he was like, "Listen, if you just need a job for a couple of months until you go to grad school, why don't you come work at the Huffington Post?" At the time, it was like the New York office was maybe 50 people. We all sat in a room just like this. There was like a DC office as well, and some folks in LA, but it was really small. It was like pre-AOL buyout, pre-Verizon buyout, which happened recently. And it was like very much like a startup. Talk about career changes. So when I was a kid, I was a big reader, but I also was really into art. Like I took a lot of art classes. I went at the Met on Sundays, had like an art class where you would go and like they would take you to different exhibits and you would like draw based on the like whatever it was. So like you'd go to the African art section and I don't know, make a mask or something. So when I was really young, I thought I was going to be like, there's actually a video of me sitting in Colonial Williamsburg talking about how I'm going to be a fashion designer. And so in high school, I interned at a fashion designer's studio for 2 summers. Cynthia Rowley was her name. And she's like sort of moderately successful. And I started at Cornell my first semester. I was a textiles and apparel major, which like is so absurd when I think about it now. But I took like fiber science courses where you would look at like different materials like under the microscope and be able to like identify whether it was like cotton or whatever based on its like molecular composition. It was absurd. It was totally absurd. Yeah, it was interesting, but it was like not. I mean, for someone, I'm much more of like a humanities kind of person. And like we did do some sort of like, history of visual design type stuff, but so yeah, thought I was gonna be a fashion designer. Had I gone to any other school but Cornell, which is the only Ivy that has any like fashion program, I would have been an English major. So I was just like, this is not quite right for me. Which was a bummer for my parents because the fashion design program was in a state, like one of Cornell's state schools. And so I was paying like in-state tuition. And then when you transfer to the art school, you have to pay full tuition. So they were very kind about not giving me a hard time about like doubling their tuition. Well, in undergrad, I wrote my senior thesis on Phil Broth, and I really loved sort of his novels and Saul Bellow and sort of Portnoy's Complaints, Philip Roth, and American Pastoral is a great novel by him. And then The Adventures of Augie March by Saul Bellow is great. I would read, you know, just lots of novels by sort of like post-45 authors. I've been reading a lot of sort of like highbrow sci-fi. Right now I'm reading this book called The Book of Strange New Things by Michael Faber, which is about a Christian missionary who goes to a different planet to like convert aliens, which sounds absurd, but is totally awesome. Last book I gave as a gift. I think I gave, so my father-in-law is a big reader. It's something we bond over. So I think I gave him, so Kate Atkinson had a book called Life After Life, which was sort of like each chapter would end and then the beginning of the next chapter would be sort of like a reset to fix the things that went wrong in the chapter previous. And then she had a sort of follow-up book called A God in Ruins, which I can't describe without spoiling the book. So I'll just leave it at that. It was really good. So I think I gave him the fuck because we had both read Life After Life, and then we both read the second book. So there's an Italian author called Elena Ferrante, or Alana Ferrante. She wrote a series of four books called the Neapolitan series, set in Sicily. It's about a friendship between two women over like 50, 60 years. First one's called My Brilliant Friend. Changed my life. I mean, you'll see them on the subway, like they have really sort of trashy covers. They look like romance novels. They're like the most amazing books ever. And she's fascinating. Well, people don't know anything about the author. Like it's a pseudonym. Italians being sort of the misogynists that they are think that it's not even a woman, that it, of course a woman couldn't write these amazing books, even though it's like she's so clearly a woman. And she just sends manuscripts to her publisher, and the publisher just sort of like, she doesn't talk to the press. It's amazing. So I haven't given those as gifts, but I've forced my friends to read those. Does that count? I'm trying to think. So there are a few books that I read multiple times throughout school. That rereading a book is like the best thing you can do. It just totally changes the way you think about it. So like Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, James Joyce. The more you read that book, like the more incredible it is and the more you see in it. And there's like so many different ways to read it. What do I wish I had known when I was 20 or 21? First of all, so if you're a junior or senior in college, that you're never gonna have as much free time, and you should use that free time as much as possible and enjoy yourself. And also just like learn things for pleasure. You're probably around the smartest people you're ever gonna be around for the rest of your life. Take advantage of that. Like if you're on a college campus, like talk to your professors, talk to your fellow students. How quickly things change. You sort of, especially in your 20s, like each year it can be totally, totally different. And you sort of think that, okay, maybe for the next 5 years I'll be doing this. And then in my late 20s, it'll be a little different. But your 20s are sort of more segmented than that. Can't ever know what's gonna happen. I was someone who was totally thought that I had a plan, and I wasn't interested in like bopping around and seeing what fit. Like I knew I wanted a particular thing, and now that I'm 29, gonna be 30 in April, like my 20s are just such a roller coaster of different moments and like plans that I had made for myself that didn't work out for a particular reason, and you know, sort of specifically in like my professional life, just really went in a totally different direction. The beginning of my senior year, I was planning on taking the LSAT and applying to law school because I loved reading and writing, and that's like what you did. You went to law school if you like those things. Or maybe you went to, you know, maybe you wanted to be a journalist, but like I didn't want to be a journalist. And then I had like, it's a long story, but I had a very unfortunate experience with the LSATs where I had to cancel my score midway, which is like not something I would ever have done or didn't think I would ever do. And I started dating someone who was in Cornell Law at the time, and he was like, just because you like reading doesn't mean you should go to law school. So I went from thinking I was going to law school to take, you know, abandoning the LSAT to planning on going to English graduate school and getting a PhD. So I had like a gap year between my senior year of college and when I started graduate school, where I worked at the Huffington Post. And I loved it, but I was like already into graduate school by the time I started at HuffPost. Like, I'm gonna be a professor no matter what anyone says, it's gonna be great. Fuck all those professors that say like there are no jobs out there, they don't know what they're talking about. Went to grad school for 3 years, started my dissertation, was like past my coursework phase, past my orals, started writing, and I was just like, this is not for me at all. Like, and it was like the hardest thing to ever do. Well, a couple of reasons. One, I was raised in New York, and I always saw myself living in New York, but when you're in academia, you can't plan your life around sort of geographic preferences. Like, you just have to be willing to go anywhere for the job, which is something we don't really make demands of anyone. I mean, some people have to go anywhere for a job, I guess, like professional athletes and soldiers, and but you know, it's like it was something that you couldn't even complain about or even, you know, sort of raise a preference. Like in graduate school, like you couldn't be like, I want to live in California for the rest of my life. Like that would be seen as an absurd demand. The other thing is that, well, there are no jobs, so my professors are right. And I love teaching. Teaching was wonderful, but I didn't love sitting alone in a room writing a book or writing a chapter of a book, which is really a lot of, certainly in the English PhD program, like what you needed to be able to be really good at. I'm much better at like collaborative work and talking things out and having people give me feedback. And so it's like, if you don't like the day-to-day of what you're doing, if you don't like sitting in a room by yourself making arguments about text, then you're not going to like it once you have a tenure-track job, if you do get one. It's just started. And on top of all of that, I was getting a PhD in English literature, and my field was 20th century American fiction. And what that led to was that every single book I read, every novel, no matter from what time period or where it was from, could potentially be relevant to my work. So reading for pleasure became non-existent. So everything, you know, because like every book, every novel you read could potentially impact your work somehow, and it just made the one thing that I love doing into my job.